delighted to welcome Professor David Hall from Harvard. He is the Bartlett Research Professor now of New England Church History at Harvard Divinity School, a distinguished authority on 17th century New England, and in fact Old England as well. He's the author of over a dozen books, including several seminal works that have defined the field. His books include The Faithful Shepherd, A History of New England Ministry in the 17th Century. Probably his most well-known book is Worlds of Wonder, Days of Judgment, Popular Religious Belief in Early New England. He's also written Puritans in the New World, a critical anthology, and most recently the book that we'll be discussing today, A Reforming People, Puritanism and the Transformation of Public Life in New England. I'll pass it around in case you would like to take a look at it, and I hope many of you will buy it today, buy it online after we see it today. He has two edited books as well, The Antinomian Controversy, and on the Antinomian Controversy and on Witch Hunting in 17th Century New England. He continues to study and write about religion and culture in early America with particular attention to lived religion, and is presently writing a general history of Puritanism in England, Scotland, and New England, circa 1550 to 1700. So he's a busy man, and we're delighted that he could take some time to be with us today. So welcome.
Thanks. Thanks to Eric and to Alan Wolf and the Center for having me. And so my own preference, just as we go forward, not knowing your collective style, but my preference is not necessarily to respond to every question or observation. I mean, I will try to respond to them all, but I'm interested in there being as wide a conversation as possible. It's more fun to do this when you can revise something later on and discover that the things that you've made are things that aren't clear. But obviously I can't do that now, but happily returning to some of this material for the book that I'm writing at the moment. So the word Puritanism, which was not actually initially going to be in the title of the book until the Connacht people said it had to be in the title of the book, is a highly charged word. In this new book I'm writing, I liken it to a snowball that just keeps gathering meanings. Just to let you know, it first appeared in English polemical discourse in the 1560s, actually launched by Catholics, but promptly taken up by people in the Church of England, now Protestant, officially Protestant, to denounce a faction that was whining about, let's get rid of some more of the Catholic stuff, as well as other things. So Puritanism is this powerful word. It remains this word in our own culture, not as powerful now as it might have been perhaps 50 years ago, because the Founding Fathers of 1776 seemed to be bear the brunt of a lot of conversation, and of course there's Lincoln and so forth and so on. But I wanted to just read, I'm going to read briefly two passages from the book to indicate my own starting point. This has to be on page 7, so it's early on. None of us is innocent when we look back at the past, for what we see or choose to emphasize is shaped by long-enduring stories of heroes and villains, reformers and their enemies, battles won and battles lost. So it is with early New England and the people who bear the very complicated name Puritan. My version of their history is, like all others, affected by the stories I inherit. In essence, two powerful stories that collide in these pages. Both date from the 17th century, although they owe their currency, I truncated this. I can't go back to the 1560s. Close to any part of this book. Both date from the 17th century, although they owe their currency to what was said about the Puritans in the 19th and the 20th. According to one of these stories, the colonists, and especially their clerical and civil leaders, set up a tightly run authoritarian regime that repressed or attempted to repress any expression of dissent. Supposedly, this regime entrusted political power to the relatively few men who were church members, and withheld it from a great, much larger number who never joined. A second version turns this story upside down. The first two Stuart kings, James I, Charles I, regarded all Puritans as anti-authoritarian malcontents, given to seditious behavior because of their refusal to abide by the rules of the Church of England. Their complaints of popery, a code name for arbitrary governance, and their emphasis on the moral law as more binding than the king's commands. Once New England came into being, the anti-authoritarianism of the colonists, which was real, dismayed modern Puritans in England who accused the immigrants of going too far. In New England itself, a local minister echoed this complaint, telling John Winthrop in 1639 that the spirits of people run high, and opining that both commonwealth and churches have descended too low, already too low in terms of abandoning hierarchy. A year later, after deciding not to immigrate to New England, wisely, Lord Say and Seale warned Winthrop that the people in New England were exaggerating the importance of liberty. What wise man would want to live where every man is a master? Or wise men propound and fools determine, he asked rhetorically. These, of course, are ancient tropes. Stigmatized on the one hand as arbitrary and authoritarian, stigmatized on the other as overly democratic or undermining of authority, thus reformed two interpretations that have persisted to the present day. So that's how I begin by framing the book. There's a second framework to the book that I'll just mention orally here, namely the coincidence of the Great Migration, founding the New England colonies, with the eruption of political unrest in England for the period that we call the English Revolution, 1640-1660. And the book opens with a, has a kind of a double opening. It opens with a making the point that despite all the hopes for the English Revolution on the part of some groups, that it would really substantially modify aristocracy, social structures, political rights, religious situation, nothing happened. Nothing happened. And so in 1660, when Charles II was restored, it's right back to the status quo, so that the Long Parliament accomplished basically very little, and under the Cromwellian regime from 1649 on, after the execution of the king, nothing is accomplished for specific structural reasons, whereas in New England, the argument is that the English Revolution was fulfilled, the promise of the English Revolution was fulfilled in New England, and I'll make that point more specifically in a moment. So there are two arguments in the book. One is to frame this contrasting view. Oh, I should say, now you already know what the answer is. I take the side of those who argue against the authoritarianism, although not trying to employ the word modern democratic. That doesn't work. And then secondly, this notion that the colonists fulfilled the English Revolution. And what happened, this was not a book that I knew I was going to write when I first started to do the research for it. But one winter's day, sometimes winter is always when these things happen to me, one winter's day I had long owned, I bought in England in the 1980s, a whole collection of leveler readings. Levelers are the golden example, the kind of poster children of possibilities for the English Revolution. Essentially a secular group, they were not interested in religion except to gain religious tolerance. And I read through a group of liberal documents, and I, as I was reading them, my hair stood on end because, frankly, the colonists had actually accomplished or exceeded nine of the 10 court level of demands. So to juxtapose the levelers and the colonists, unheard of, absolutely unheard of, because people slotted the colonists into this nasty category, and the levelers into this ideal category, or in general, that's sort of unless you're a monarchist or a whatever. Not too many of those left around. The I know some French people who still believe in monarchy. In any case, so that was a kind of starting point for this very, very strong argument about the relationship between the colonial political process and the English situation. So what the book does is tries to revitalize political history. There'd been close to a 40-year abeyance in people writing on the political history of New England. The conversation came to an end in the early 70s. And so I'm trying to revive, speak to a silence, and speak to a silence by this close comparative work by showing linguistically and in terms of social practice or political practice the continuities and transitions and disruptions with which the colonists were involved. It covers all five colonies because it covers dozens of towns because I got, there's of course a political process in towns. They had formed governments just as colonies had formed governments. And so again, it's an attempt to revitalize another absolutely inert subject. and then to look at land holding, land distribution, and you would not be surprised to know that the crux of town politics was not, you know, who was selectman or who was, you know, your Hargreave. It was how land was distributed, and then secondly, whether the fences were kept in order because the hogs were destroying everybody's crops, and this is a bitter, bitter issue in towns. And then also conserving trees. You might think there were godzillion trees, but actually there were not enough trees to go around for everybody. So when I say revitalized politics, what makes it appropriate for me to be here at this center is that this was politics with values put back in. The one way in which my being at the Divinity School for some 20-odd years has influenced this book, the way I feel it's influenced this book, is that I take seriously the fact that the colonists tried to write themselves back into the New Testament. They really believed in New Testament values, the Pauline values of mutuality, edification, charity, love, etc. And then they had other values that they were bringing from humanist and other contexts. And here I foreground a word that, again, some novelty in foregrounding of the word equity, which had long since left its legal context and become a synonym for justice and fairness. And on a literal count, it's the most used word in their ethical vocabulary. And it has an enormous role. It's the standard by which you judge political actions. Has land been distributed equitably? And every town group of selectmen, everybody has to answer to this standard. Now, of course, you can fudge this. I mean, it's a debatable, what is equity? That's where the politics lies. What constitutes equity? That's a political question. But I very much wanted to bring ethics in. And then the concluding chapter was an experiment in writing a community history, which again is a genre that imploded in the early 70s, or died in the early 70s. And I happened to write about Cambridge, Massachusetts, Cambridge, but it's because the records are superb that I wrote about Cambridge. And here the question was, the classic question, less in the New England literature than in the British literature, which, again, I was keying this book to in large part, whether the godly, self-designated group, obviously, whether the godly would monopolize resources and discriminate against those in a community who were not the godly. And so here you have church records, town records, land distribution records, some, unfortunately, the court records don't start until, civil court records don't begin until 49, or survive before 49. You had an amazingly articulate minister, Thomas Shepherd, talking about all these matters, and then other people commenting on the town at the same time, wills, so forth and so on, all of which I drew upon to construct a town history, church history, predicated on a very interesting situation. Shepherd announced one day to the world he was going to leave Cambridge and go down to Connecticut, which his father-in-law had done before him, Thomas Clifford found Hartford. And the general court went through, we can't have you go, what will it take to keep you here? And he was going to take everybody with him, of course. And he said, well, we need some better land. This land is crappy here in Cambridge, which it was. It's a alluvial plain. So they said, okay, well, how about 8,000 acres? Here, 8,000 acres inland. And so it wasn't until starting in 1648 and then finally in 1652 that the town distributes this land. So it gave me a marvelous hook on which to hang the story. What would they do when they came to distribute the land? Because the land was given to the church. The land was given to the church, not to the town. It was given to the church. So I'm not going to tell you the end of the story enough to make you read to see what actually happens. But it was, again, an experiment at contradicting the well-known story of declension, namely that social greed, self-interest drives out the religious values. I mean, that's the narrative of a zillion stories of early New England. And the question was, could I create an alternative narrative to the not denying self-interest, not denying greed? And I quote with some pleasure the longest single page in the town records, which is a list of 46 people accused of violating the ordinance about preserving timber. And it starts with the ruling elder of the church. I mean, this is, you know, it's not, you know, the highest lay spiritual leader in the town is on this list, a man who otherwise is revered in the town. I thought there's an accountability, and so it's an argument for the persistence of the values as effective values, always in dialectic with what we everyday experience in our own lives, of course. So that's the book. Just to summarize, it's not about Puritanism as a whole. It's not about Puritanism as a theology. It's not about Puritanism in terms of its aura or whatever. It's really about on-the-ground social and political practices, transposing the religious into these practices, but always those practices as informed by ideas or values, biblical figures. There's a considerable attention to the Book of Revelation and what that meant to the colonists. And then because there's a legal historian here, I want to read just one other section, which is probably my favorite section. Without any of the fanfare or controversy that surrounded the making of the Congregational Way, the colonists created a legal system remarkably different from its English counterpart. Publicly, the organizers of the Massachusetts Bay Company said nothing about these changes, as immigration was getting underway. With one exception, no one in the 1630s spelled out the reasons for doing so. Said these changes owed their being to a long-standing tradition of complaints about the law that also prompted the Long Parliament and its successor to the 1650s to attempt, but never accomplish, a major reworking of the English legal system. I'm going to skip over the publication of the Book of the General Laws and Liberties Concerning the Abbots of Massachusetts, printed in 1648 here in Cambridge, which is the first printed code of laws in the Western world. The Laws and Liberties, and also the one that has amazingly devices that you can easily look things up in. It's a layperson's manual, and printed in 600 copies, so it can be very widely distributed. The Laws and Liberties was the fruit of prolonged agitation in England about the excessive costs of doing legal business, the length of time it took to resolve civil disputes, the remoteness of most courts from where people actually lived, the obscurity of the law, the greediness of lawyers, the corruption of justice, the harsh treatment of debtors and thieves, and the privileges granted the aristocratic class. Four major strands of reform figured in the making of the Laws and Liberties in the system of courts. The first of these concerned procedures in the geography of doing legal business. Outlet law French, still in use in England in the 1630s. And in came a cluster of rights and privileges for plaintiffs and defendants with virtually no equivalent in English law, a rule that no one could be imprisoned before the law had sentenced him. The possibility of bail in all but exceptional cases, the right of appeal to a higher court, and the privilege of both plaintiffs and defendants to represent themselves. Out went barristers, eliminated in order to prevent, quote, unjust, frequent, and endless suits, unquote, together with any argument or pleas based on legal technicalities. In came the relocating of legal business to towns and counties, with local magistrates or committees of freedmen in power to hear small causes in quarter courts or county courts, all others except those involving life or banishment. In came procedures for reimbursing witnesses and a resolution to avoid delay, with cases to be taken up at the next court once someone has been charged. In came careful record-keeping of evidence and decisions, quote, so such as shall have just cause to have their causes reviewed could put it to good use. In came a much more impartial method of selecting juries. Out went the sale of offices and the possibility of judges enriching themselves through fees. Out went torture. The second strand concerned crimes and penalties. In came, and this is in some ways, a medievalist friend of mine at Harvard on Sunday was mentioning the figure of 75,000 people being executed under the reign of Henry VIII. Someone said, well, maybe it's only 35,000 by hanging for felony. Okay. Second strand concerned crimes and penalties. In came a dramatic simplifying of felonies for which the death penalty was warranted. No reiteration of the English rule that theft of property valued at more than one shilling was a capital offense. As many as a third of all criminal cases for theft in early 17th century England concluded with judges opposing the death sentence. A percentage that would have been much higher had juries and magistrates not colluded to avoid some aspects of the law. In place of the death penalty, the colonists instituted restitution, the most frequent punishment assigned, as a quote from a historian, for such crimes. They added a procedural rule based on scripture that no one could be convicted of a capital crime for any offense without the testimony of two or three witnesses. They curtailed the possibility of imprisonment for debt and recast the legal consequences of suicide, mitigating the, and I quote someone, revolting barbarities of the English law that mandated the confiscation of a person's property. And then I refer to laws about the distribution of property, the coming in of partible inheritance, and so forth and so on. And Sam, what this is, talk about revolutions in contrast to the English situation. Those of you who know Bert B.P. Thompson or others on the law in England, it's just absolutely astonishing. What's doubly astonishing is that people don't, first of all, most people don't know this. Most historians don't know this, although I was able to quote my late friend Jerry Warden as calling attention to this unnoticed piece of 1978. And most people don't grasp the significance of this. I mean, it just changed the fabric of everyday life. It just changed the fabric of how you work. And I quote, in the chapter on Cambridge, I quote Thomas Shepard endorsing these and calling for complete transparency. That everything has to be transparent in the way that a community's law works or the way in which a town's decision-making is working. Again, that's the English system, be it legal or even other way that's cloaked in back chamber stuff. It just was cloaked in back chamber stuff. So let me stop here.